From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Friday when a Brockport teacher was one of just five teachers across the country to be inducted in the National Teachers Hall of Fame. His name is Christopher Albrecht, and he was the 2018 New York State Teacher of the Year. During his year with that title, he traveled quite a bit, talked to students, teachers, parents, administrators. He's been thinking a lot about how we love our kids and celebrate their gifts in class. In fact, think about that term, gifted. Do we apply it too narrowly? This hour, it's a chance to talk to who the kids call Mr. Albrecht, not just about the distinction he's received last week, but how he views the state of education and the ways to make it better. We're going to talk about everything from literacy, safety, giftedness, loving our children, what goes on during the summer. I mean, it's just a lot. We're going to try to get through it all with Christopher Albrecht, who is a teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport. Nice to see you, as always.
It's great to see you again, Evan.
Well, you were, based on your Twitter feed, overwhelmed with the distinction last week. And, you know, I got to ask you about that off the top here. You're one of five teachers inducted to the National Teachers Hall of Fame. What did it mean to you?
Oh, it was a wonderful honor. You know, it's one of those things where you kind of... Over the past 2 years, I've had the chance to reflect a lot about why me? You know, why am I that person when I see somebody in my own hallway at school doing things that I look to and, you know, and copy and say, wow, that's a great idea. So it's not that I have all the answers, but I think what I would say is the success that I've had over my whole career, really, and then these two distinctions, is that I'm surrounded by a wonderful school. Of educators in the Hill School in Brockport that are just creative. We all seem like we're on the same page, and I think that's a very strong positive for a community when the teachers are going in the same direction in the school. It seems that our school is pretty connected to the community, and we've got a great, Brockport's just a fantastic town to live in. I live there and teach there. And then, you know, throw in there, I have an amazing administrator in Mr. Broughton in our building. And then throw in my own home life. My wife is extremely generous with not having me at home and putting in those extra hours that are needed, especially with some of the kids that need that. You mentioned giftedness, that need that extra something, or those kids that need a little extra help that need that extra something. So I guess everybody needs that. So I would say this is more of a kind of a team win. The credit really goes to the people, my loving parents too, that supported me all along. That you know, when you're surrounded by goodness, good things seem to happen to you.
No, I hear you when you say it's not like baseball. It's not like you had 15 seasons of batting 300, so it was
easy
to look at the stats.
No.
I mean, these are much more subjective metrics.
Yeah.
But when you found out that you were going to be inducted, what was your first feeling when you got that news?
Oh, my first feeling was I was a little worried about my dad because he had broken his arm about a month before, and he's in his 80s. And all of a sudden, we had the spelling bee at the Hill School. I mean, I'm a fourth grade teacher, and I'm in charge of the spelling bee. And we had just handed out the dictionaries to the five finalists, the five people at the top, and the principal and I were together. And then all of a sudden, people were walking into the cafeteria, and they had planned it that the fourth grade would be in there with me, and they announced that I was going into the Teachers Hall of Fame. And the first thought that I had was, oh my gosh, I haven't seen my dad out of the house in a while. So I was more nervous about his health than anything. And then it kicked in that this was a reality. One of the greatest things, I live my life for my students. And Ben Olson, who's a United States Marine right now serving in the Middle East, he's on his third tour. And they got him on the screen, Skyped him on the screen in the cafeteria. So he was in the cafeteria with us during that. So thankful to my principal for making that possible because he's one of those, you know, many students that I've stayed in touch with for a long time.
Well, and here you are now. So a couple of years of distinctions. I don't know what's left for you to be honored with. So we'll just appreciate the conversation with you for the hour.
Thank
here.
You.
You know, during your year with the title of Teacher of the Year, you told us you were going to travel a lot. You did. You talked to a lot of people. What do you think you gained most from the work that you did with that title and the people you met?
That's a great question. Well, it's twofold. There's when you become a State Teacher of the Year, there were seven engagements that we have to do on the national level. So we were in Washington, D.C. We were trained in public speaking, how to incorporate narratives, different things, you know, so we're more polished and refined in front of an audience. And then also we went out to California and to Google headquarters and different places like that. So we took a look at some of the newer trends in education. I did go to the primary school, which is Mr. Zuckerberg, so the person that owns Facebook. We did visit his school. So I got to see some of the cutting edge things that are out there. But I would say the thing that had the most impact on me was staying right here in our state. And I decided that I would visit schools. I visited 76 different schools during my year on top of teaching fourth grade and spent my time in classrooms teaching, not just going in and being a celebrity, but I did it more under the radar and passed out books to students also that related to what I was teaching. And I taught lessons on resiliency and honesty and honor and different things like that. But what is amazing to me is after 76 different schools, there's no two schools alike in New York State. You can be next door to somebody, even within our own city of Rochester. The diversity is unbelievable. And whether it's socioeconomic diversity, cultural diversity, gender diversity, even just the feel of the buildings in terms of energy level is different for each place that I visited.
Does that bring challenge? I mean, what stands out about having no two schools alike, even right next to each other?
Yeah, that is a challenge because we're public education. A lot of the policy that we face is out of Albany, you know, and the Department of Education. So when they make a decision, it affects all of us, but we're all coming at education from different lenses. And that makes it a challenge. So I think that after seeing so many different schools, the most important component is that a school board and the people in charge of the school, the teachers and the students and the community, are in great communication with each other. They're in sync with each other. And there's always going to be policies and standards coming from a much larger entity like Albany. But the most important thing that impacts our students is community relations. And that communication piece between the teacher and the home, those intimate relationships between student and teacher that needs so bad to be fostered. There's a buzzword or kind of a buzz phrase right now that I've heard a few teachers speak of, and it's called Maslow before Bloom's. And I see you nodding your head with that. In other words, if Maslow talks about the social emotional piece, we really need to take care of that before we go into deeper thinking with Bloom's. And that only happens when we foster relationships between teachers and students. And that's becoming more. I knew it before this whole couple years happened, but it's becoming more and more obvious that the schools that really are taking the time to do that are seeing not just emotional growth, but also academic growth as well.
There's so much. I mean, like, there's so much I want to talk about. Just based
this
on
could
what
be
just,
a three-hour show.
And so let's hit this Maslow's part first here, because when we talk about a hierarchy of needs, it's no surprise that a child who has nutritional deficiencies is already at a disadvantage. And a child that has sleep deficiencies, a child that may be categorically homeless, living with family but moving from home to home or couch to couch. All of these things, if you just look at a hierarchy of needs, are a problem and a challenge. When it comes to the role of the teacher and the school itself, how much can be done to deal with that? And then how much do you think could change to allow for more to be done? In other words, how do you see sort of what's happening now, status quo? And what would you like to see change to address Maslow before you get to Bloom?
Well, that's a great question. Well, you know, I'm thinking about my own classroom or some of the classrooms that I've seen. You're right. There are students out there that are that are not given the advantage that other students are. It's not unusual to find out that a child doesn't have a bed or is getting a food link bag to take home with them, and that'll be their food for that evening or for the weekend. So those things are a reality that we're facing. So that's coming out of situations where there's poverty. And the one initiative that was I saw put in about 10 years ago, we started focusing on early childhood interventions. And that, I go back to that primary school out in California, that what they're trying to do is from about 6 months on up till kindergarten, they're putting in programs to start helping children, especially in the area of literacy, because we are facing a nationwide crisis in literacy right now for multiple reasons. But I would argue a little different. When I was raising, I mean, you're a dad, I'm a dad, and when I was raising my kids, when I had a screaming kid all night for, you know, and everybody that's a parent can relate to this, where you've got a kid that's crying through the night, you're tired, you're trying your best, you're doing your best. And then somebody's telling you, well, you know, you've got to do this right now too. I don't know if that's the right time to attack childhood literacy. So I would advocate just a little different. And this is something that, I've brought forth to Mrs. Elia. I'm not 100% sure she is totally on board with the idea yet, but I haven't given up hope. But what I would like to see is that we start teaching at the secondary level about how do you successfully maintain a marriage? How do you successfully raise children? The pressure's off when you don't have the kids, so it's more proactive and more thoughtful to get people ready to face those challenges, because raising kids is tough. And the one expendability is, well, reading to my kid. And people do that. And then there's a lot of distractions that go along with it now. If you go on a bus or you go downtown or anything, even just here, I didn't see a single person reading a book today while they were waiting. But you see everybody on their cell phones right now, and those are snippets of time. So even as a society, we're becoming less and less literate in terms of reading sustained pieces of literature or pieces of informational text. So those that needs to be brought back as well.
Talking to Christopher Albrecht, the New York State Teacher of the Year for the year 2018 and a recent inductee into the National Teachers Hall of Fame, I think about my son who really lacks for so little. I mean, he's really a child of advantage. But his teacher this year, she's writing in his journal, "I love you." She's writing, she's overt about making the kids feel like no matter who you are, what your background is, I'm not afraid to tell you I love you. I'm not afraid to say those words. I want you to feel it when you're in this classroom, knowing that some of those kids have the advantages that a child like my son has, and some may not really ever hear that. You comfortable with that phrase? You want to hear that phrase more often? Is it okay to talk about love with our students, our kids?
I believe it is, as long as it's interpreted the correct way.
Yeah.
You know, I would hesitate at first. I think those are phrases that might be said later on in the year once relationships are built.
Sure.
You know, you don't want to, and frankly, I don't love somebody right out of the chute. That would be a very unusual thing to say to somebody you just met, whether it's a child or an adult. But after those relationships are built, yeah, I'm pretty, how are you? What do you feel about it?
I thought it was beautiful because, and I think it really did develop as the year went on, but I think that they appropriately love their students and they're not afraid to tell them. And, you know, he happens to be in a class with a really wide range of life situations for his classmates. Some he's aware of, some he is not. As his dad, I know more about some of that background than he does. But I really admired the way his two women in the classroom teaching, one sort of what we would call a main teacher. But boy, it was just, it was natural. And it meant something to those kids. And when they left on the last day, it was really interesting to see the connection, because they felt like there is someone who truly cares about me and has taken the time to learn about me.
And sounds like great. Do a shout out to the district. Which district is it?
That's East Rochester.
East Rochester, great district. You know, that's the only
outstanding.
The only one campus school system besides Brockport, too. We are all on one campus,
yeah,
I believe, in East Rochester.
It is. And yeah. And I have been so pleased with that. And so that's just sort of one observation as I think about Maslow's, because, you know, when I think about hierarchy of needs, you know, my own son is really well taken care of. But it's a wide range in this world. And it's a wide range in his own single classroom. So I'm glad to see teachers building real relationships beyond just what did you learn? Here's your homework. But when it comes to the time, I want to talk to you about expectations on teachers and the time spent in classroom and how much freedom you have versus don't have. And I really want to kind of get your take as a teacher at the fourth grade level versus someone who's doing third grade with testing, eighth grade with testing, high school, and what changes, right? When I think about Common Core, before I became a parent, really when things were kind of taken off with Common Core, there's a lot of parents who've been upset about different things. Interestingly enough, I see some of the math homework and I'm like, oh, that makes sense. They're trying to make him think about things in different ways here. And like, I kind of think a lot of it's cool. But the idea with Common Core, if you go back to the people who created it, were they want there to be a national set of core standards that all students are going to be learning before there is sort of a diversity of experience. In other words, I think about all the schools you went to and how different they were school to school to school. And the idea with Common Core is, well, at the very least, no matter how different things are school to school, you're going to have that core set of math knowledge, of social studies, whatever the case may be. The complaint among some teachers is it's become so limiting in terms of what they have to do and then the tests that have to be given, that they don't have a whole lot of time to diversify things or to respond to what their community is like. I want to know if that is too general a critique or if you agree with it, and how you view the time and freedom that teachers have or don't have.
Well, I do stand in the same ballpark as you with Common Core. There is an importance for equity in education, that if you, whatever school you go to, you should be getting an equal education. And the fact is, different communities, there is an inequity. You referred to your own son as coming from a place of privilege, and then there's other people or other children and adolescents that are not. From a fourth grade standpoint, the Common Core curriculum, when it was rolled out originally, so I'm going to go at this from more of a historical perspective. It was rolled out very fast, and what that did is as a teacher and going through my own experience and watching it happen in my own building, is the speed at which it was rolled out not only panicked teachers, because it was associated to testing and those tests had an implication on our schools. It also had an effect on parents, especially in math, I would say, because the new methods were confusing. They were different than the way we were brought up. And so that rollout being so fast, it really was it was almost like a lead balloon flying out of the sky. The impact of that is teachers or schools really focused heavily on curriculum at that point. So a lot of our discussions and staff meetings, and it's not unique to Brockport, it's across the state, we're trying to grapple with, well, how are we going to teach this and what's it going to look like and different protocols that we were using in the classroom. And what that got away from is really talking about the important pieces of, well, our teaching methods. And teaching methods go more into a lot of the respect issues, resiliency, grit, those kind of areas we got away from for a time period. And I think that's why we saw a little bit of a change in the way school communities looked at things and acted. And we're getting back to that. We're starting to see the value of it. There is more of a comfort level. One of the challenges is that the big buzzword now is fluid curriculum fluid curriculum. So the curriculum is changing. So each year we will see change in curriculum. But there's a comfort level in having taught something for 3 or 4 or 5 years where then you're not thinking so much about the curriculum and you're thinking more about the student that's in front of you. So again, that student that's in front of us is so much more important. Their life, their humanness is so much more important than what we teach, that you could teach anything. So my point of view on this is, if you're getting into teaching, this goes out to more, I guess, the educational community out there. If you're getting into teaching because you love math or you love language arts, you're getting in for the wrong reason. What you got have to love are the students that are in front of you first. So when that teacher says, I love you, and authentically means it, that truly is the reason we get into teaching. When I got into teaching, I thought, well, the things that I want to teach science and all that. But really, as you get older, you realize, no, it's not that. It's the connections that I make with those students that are in front of me, and not just through the curriculum itself, but the social-emotional growth, the stories that they bring to school. Every child's different and unique, and getting to know their uniqueness is so important.
Talking to Christopher Albrecht, the New York State Teacher of the Year 2018, an inductee into the New York State, the National Teachers Hall of Fame. It was a group of five, right?
It was just five of us, yeah.
You enjoyed those conversations with them? Did you have some time?
So the only difference between, the uniqueness, let's put it that way, the uniqueness of the National Teachers Hall of Fame is you have to have 20 years of experience in a public school classroom setting, and I do. And a lot of those conversations that we had there were very cordial, educated, very respectful. My cohort were from all different parts of the country. The closest person is David. He's from Connecticut, but there's a lady from Florida, Mary. Richard's from Nevada, and then Diane is from Kansas. So it's a unique bunch. We're getting different looks at things and getting to talk to each other. We've kept in touch very closely. We were in Washington, D.C. 5 or 6 weeks ago together just to meet each other first and to do a couple things in work-wise. And then this past week, we spent a significant time. The Hall of Fame is in Emporia, Kansas, which is a lot like Cooperstown, a small town. And they do it Kansas style there. They incorporate you into the town. It wasn't like staying in fancy places, eating fancy food. It was root beer floats in the park, listening to the municipal band with a host family. There was a host family, the Krugers, 82 years old, two retired teachers that were there for my wife and myself. And then my dad came out on Thursday. And it was a very hometown, relaxed feel. Every window in every shop had our names up, and there's just this hometown pride there that was so evident, so authentic and genuine, just welcoming. I feel like for a week I felt like an Emporian. I didn't feel like an imposter. So.
Well, and now let's connect that to how you see the value of community in schools. I mean, if every community treated the kids in our schools that way, it would be different. And I know you can't snap your fingers overnight and make that happen, but what can we do to create more of that connection within communities and the kids in the schools?
Well, I'll tell you a neat story. I was down in Portville, New York. So Portville is down by Olean, and I went to St. Bonaventure University. So I was down in that area, and I student taught at Portville, and I met a principal there, and he took me around, and then I spent my day there. But they had just finished a project down there. There was a movie that came out a few years ago with Julia Roberts that was called Wonder. And there's a book. The book is phenomenal. And it's about a student that has a disfigurement and just the life of this child. And it's written in the first person. And it's about his life. Well, what they decided to do, this is to the point of the community, this school felt like one of the safest schools that I've been in years. And they had minimal security. And the reason it felt safe was, I'll attribute it to projects like this. They had the whole school district, kindergarten through 12th grade, read this book. Every student was given a copy. It wasn't from the library. A copy of Wonder was bought for them, but they went one step further. They purchased about 600 more books and went to the community. And they went to the barbershops and the mayor's office and the grocery store and asked the owners, will you have your entire staff read this? And then they gave out a schedule. So the conversations that were happening in school on chapter 12 were the same conversations that week that were happening at the hair salon that week. And at the mayor's office and the police department, all these great places. And what they did was they did lawn signs, and they put lawn signs out that said, reading the book Wonder with Portville Central Schools. And I think programs like that, where we're putting ourselves on the same page, trying to align the thoughts and giving people that experience of what's happening up at the school, just creating that interest level. We don't need people necessarily to come in and volunteer to know what's going on, but we need people to know what's going on. And that kind of initiative right there, it was amazing to see the warmth in the town, the pride in the town of the school. The school was the center of all thought, and the school itself had a lot of pride and unity. The kids were calm. Every student I passed there said hello and welcomed me. There just seemed to be a sense of pride, and it comes because of the alignment of the community in the school. So that would be an example of an initiative that kind of illustrates what I'm getting at in terms of community relations.
No, that's great. I mean, I love that story. And even if not everyone in a mayor's office or a barbershop is reading it, if you get enough people involved, kids are going to feel maybe more connected with what they're doing.
And there was a little pressure, you know, if you didn't have a lawn sign out there saying reading it with Portville, you wanted on board because everybody was doing it. So, you know, that's there's nothing wrong with a little pressure to go the right direction. Sometimes we need those gentle nudges.
I like that. Now, when it comes to the freedom of time teachers have, there's also the question of the pressure to teach to the test, and then the pressure to identify kids who may stand out, be exceptional, be gifted. And gifted in our country often goes back to a few core subjects. You know, how did you score on math? Are you, your scores gifted there? How did you score on reading and writing? And I know you did a TEDx talk on just kind of this subject right here, what it means to be gifted and the way we look at it. Is it too narrow? Do we define gifted too narrowly?
Well, it depends on the school. some schools have it correct, and some schools are going a different direction with it. You know, I would throw in there, Evan, that we also have an incorporation of STEAM or STEM teaching now, where that seems to be the replacement for the term gifted. And we have to be careful with that. I would picture this. So if you're listening, if you can picture three circles, almost like the Olympic rings, but not five Olympic rings, three rings. And next to one ring, you would put the word talent, which is what we tend to think about when we think about gifted. But there's two other parts to being gifted that are ignored. So you might have somebody that's brilliant, but they also need creativity. And creativity is part of that gifted process. And if you don't have creativity, a lot you might not be able to think outside the box or really have those connections outside of the realm of, you know, common conventional thought. You might not be able to break the rules of conventional thought. So you need that creativity piece to be gifted. You do need talent, but I would throw in that there's a third ring, and that's work ethic. And if you don't have work ethic, a lot doesn't get done. So you might have somebody brilliant, but if they're lazy, are they really going to be, you know, are they really going to make progress? Are they really truly going to be successful? And I would argue no, that hard work, if you really look at historically what things have driven success, yes, people need talent, but the creative work ethic and hard just rolling up your sleeves and getting after it seems to be the way that, you know, that a lot of successful things have happened. And that seems, in my mind, that seems to be the American way. If you look at historically, we are a country of roll up your sleeves and get to work. And we need to keep reminding ourselves to continue to do that in the tradition of this country and education.
So when it comes to gifted, how do we measure that enough, or what is a teacher's job in recognizing and fostering that?
Well, the challenge is this: the three core areas in a school that are highly valued are math, reading, and writing. And you know, if you come to school, if you are not talented or have not been nurtured in math, reading, and writing, your chances of being that gifted student go way, way down, because those seem to be the areas that schools value. What I would argue is that we need to look at, not ask a student, are you good at math, reading, and writing? Those are important, and those need to be a part of our instructional practice. But we need to ask, what are you good at, or what are you interested in? What are you creative with? What do you like to work on? And then capitalize on those, because every child is gifted in some way. We just need to break through those barriers to find out. And that's a very unconventional way to look at it. But if we're going to have a society of children and adolescents that believe in themselves, which is a foundation of all success, we need to find out what those students truly love and are passionate about and are gifted in. And we need to capitalize on that to build that self-belief and then tackle those things that they might not be as good at.
So without naming names from your most recent class, just name two or three or four areas in which you can think of that you discovered over time, this is where this child is gifted.
Great question. I would say there was a young lady that I worked on a project. She was absolutely passionate about outer space. And if she'll know it's her if she's listening right now. But we ended up going in the community and doing a project on a Clarkson resident from the late 1800s named Lewis Swift. And it was well attended at the Morgan Manning House in Brockport. But she was passionate about that. Now, did that take extra time on my part to research that and help her do a presentation in the community? Yes. But was that a turning point in her life? Was that a huge moment in that girl's life to grow? Absolutely. I have another boy again, this is, if Brockport's listening, that we're such a tight town. Everybody knows each other out there. This one boy, we just finished a 5K 2 weeks ago, and he wants to be a police officer. His dream is to be a police officer. He's passionate about becoming a police officer, but he also has cerebral palsy. And then to gain that, what does he need to do? Well, he's explained that he needs to run. So for the past 4 years, we've run an after-school running program. He's gone from running 100 yards to running 5Ks. And not just running 5Ks, but running them in the low 30s now. We're starting to get down in time. And he's become, what's neat about it is he doesn't just run with me now. I can run with other people on the team, and he's now running with his peers. So his esteem and independence have grown as a result of looking at what he's interested in. but not giving up on, you know, math, reading, writing. If you take a look, this is a society that needs literacy, so we have to be instructing those things. We can't just divorce those things and do what the kids want, but we also need to be very conscious to get those kids to want to learn and to want to be lifelong learners well beyond, you know, their school years are over. We have to somehow tap into what they're passionate about.
All right, so I was going to break, but I want to follow that question up because
sure.
I'm thinking about a lot of young kids that I know now. I mean, I coach soccer, and you get to know the kids on your team. You get to know what sort of will motivate them or fire them up. You hear the way their parents communicate with them about different things, and it's very interesting. And there's, you know, there's some small population of kids now, even from a pretty early age, who get pretty locked into technology. Some who may be addicted to technology. I mean, I'm a little worried about not my son, but in some cases. But let's say you've got a student who they're telling you, well, my passion is video games. That's my passion. That's what I want to do. Do you say to yourself, well, then I'm going to steer them into something interesting like video game design or technology-based jobs? Or do you think, I'm not positive that's the best sense of passion. Let's find something else. You know, how do you kind of navigate that? Because video games and stuff like that, I honestly, they make me squeamish a little bit.
Yep, me too. And screen time with even computers playing Minecraft, all those games out there, they're addicting games.
And they're meant to be addicting.
They're meant to be addicting.
Yeah.
An amount of screen time a lot of these kids are facing is getting more and more. And it's not always helping their health, I don't believe. You can definitely sense a child that's been playing video games for hours on end. Their brains are different. Their responses to things are different. Their communication skills are quite different. So let's say, okay, so you're given the scenario that a student is passionate about video games. How do you steer that? Probably steer it in the direction of coding on something like that and start seeing, are they interested in design? Because design of a video game is not necessarily sitting in front of a screen.
Right.
That involves mathematics. That involves animation,
creativity.
Art, creativity. So I would steer in that direction and see. And then, you know, after they explore those areas, like facilitating their education, I would ask, you know, are you still that passionate, or are you just like playing games? Because when we look at our lives, a lot of people go to college and they go to college for what they're passionate about. And that can be good, but that can also be very negative because a lot of people are coming out of college and can't find a job. And we need to be very realistic which direction we're pushing kids to for careers and then say, well, you're also going to have free time. So in my case, my passion, I love geology and I love baseball. There's no way I was going to be a professional baseball player. My body just is not able to do some of those things that those talented athletes have. And there's not a lot of money or jobs in geology. But I do both in my spare time, like my free time. So it's okay to say that's not going to be my career. Your passion does not need to be your career, but it can be part of your life. And those messages need to be very clear. So saying I'm going to be a professional gamer right there, probably want to steer in a direction of understanding what that truly means.
Yeah. I'm going to edit myself. I was going to tell a story, but I'm going to gear back and choose to go in a different direction.
Oh, I wanted to hear that story.
Maybe out there. There's one other point before the break, which is that I'm thinking of a conversation with one of the really creative people I know in this town, and his name is Tony Colon. And Tony, if you're listening over at Fuego Coffee in Rochester, one of the really great coffee shops in this city, Tony and his wife Renee were on this program, and Tony talked about how when he was growing up, the school system that he was in sort of labeled him, you know, like a poor learner, a kid who just wasn't, you know, couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he is an amazingly creative type, but quote-unquote traditional learning, narrowly defined, was hard for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it took some time for him to get a path. Well, now he's part of the fabric of Rochester, you know, and he's got this amazing business that he and Renee created. They fly to Guatemala. They have these partnerships with people who really need them. And they're creating not just a place where you can go buy coffee, but there's a community. But for a long time, society was telling him that there was something wrong because he learned differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what scares me a little bit. And it sounds like what you're kind of pushing or advocating for is the idea that whether it's Tony or other kids, not just sort of narrowly defining that you get it, you don't, you know, kind of trying to work more individually.
Oh, yeah. And what you're going to find, and it's my experience, 25 years of teaching now, that's my experience. When you take the route of looking at, you know, that balance between looking at what students are passionate in and want to go the direction, or gifted in, what the gifted model now that we've defined, if we go that direction, what ends up happening is their growth level in the core subject areas where we talked about Common Core just a minute ago, their reading levels go up faster, their writing improves quite significantly, mathematics improve. We have out in Brockport a very similar story. Jimmy Z owns a place there, and the town loves Jimmy. And he went a very non-traditional path as well, and he's probably the most successful business owner in Brockport right now. And its success does not have to be defined by the standard, you know, the standard code of the way we're supposed to behave. There seems to be a norm in the way that we're supposed to go. Creative thought and hard work are just as important as natural talent. And those things, I think, are undervalued at times. And a lot of people, a lot of teachers have said, yep, there's not a lot of time in the day for that, especially with creative thought. And what suffers in that case would be writing. Writing needs creative thought and thinking outside the box. Yeah.
Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back with Christopher Albrecht, who is a teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport, the 2018 New York State Teacher of the Year, and a recent inductee to the National Teachers Hall of Fame, we're going to talk a little bit more about work ethic. And you said that resiliency, that kind of that grit, seems to be coming back. I want to know how. I want to know how it can be fostered. So we're going to talk about that. And some of our listeners, even this morning when we kind of teased ahead to the program, were curious to know what he thinks about some of the debates in education and right here in Rochester, a possible state takeover of the school board and more. So we'll talk about all of those things and more next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we talk to New York State lawmakers back from Albany. The session is over. We talk about what got done, climate action and more, but also what didn't get done, marijuana legalization. That's in our first hour. In our second hour, meet Abby McCarthy, who went for a run, and 6 months later, she had run just about every street, hundreds of miles in the city of Rochester. What she learned from that experience on Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're enjoying this gorgeous Friday afternoon. And, you know, Christopher Albrecht is someone who, you know, it's probably gets asked lots of questions about politics, about hard issues. Part of the job, I think, is being a teacher of the year is people want to know what you think. Well, some of our listeners do want to know what you think about this idea of a possible state takeover of the Rochester City School Board. What do you think?
Well, that's a great question right there. Now, I won't say that I have a tremendous background in I was on the show with Adam Urbanski, Van White. And I know what I've read in the newspaper, but I also know the reality of what working in the schools are and living in the community are versus what you read. So I don't know if I can fully give you a complete answer on it because I live in Brockport and I teach in Brockport, and I don't think it'd be fair to judge the community at all or the schools. From what I've visited, I visited 8 schools in Rochester last year, and those schools are working hard. I know there's safety is a major issue in those schools, and there's a lot of poverty in our city of Rochester, and those things play a heavy role in equity for our students. And there seems to be, even within the city of Rochester itself, differences between the schools. I do not, from what I've read and from what I feel, from what I've listened to, and I have attended some meetings, I don't feel a strong coherence between what the community sees, what the school board sees, and also what the goals of the school are. So in drawing a hard line on this thing, Mrs. Elia has proposed to the takeover that you're referring to right there. I think the major question has to be asked by the community, is the school board in it for the kids? And if they are, then their decisions should be solid. But what I'm getting right now is there's a lot of questions about that school board members, there's a lot of indifference on that school board, and that's concerning right there, because we need people to be in alignment with kids. I would put a lot of trust into the neighborhoods, but you know, it's a two-way street. When we're looking at poverty and we're looking at some of the challenges that come with that, that means more time away from home oftentimes. If a family is struggling economically, and that's they're saying, well, that's the reason why, I would argue, no. The school is going to come as hard as they can and try and give every opportunity. If the school is given, the first question I would ask if I'm Mrs. Elia is not necessarily looking at the school board. Are the schools themselves giving every opportunity they possibly can give to these kids? Then it's a two-way street, because then these families that are given every opportunity better be taking advantage of those opportunities to grow. So a lot of times what I'm seeing is opportunities are there, but if you're a student and you're not taking advantage of those opportunities and trying to grow, if you're not seeing the school as a positive place, the school needs to continue to stay steadfast to be positive, but it needs to be a two-way street, that the community themselves need to be trying to pick themselves up, and the schools need to continue to really try to offer opportunities, especially, you know, there is such inequity right now, especially in impoverished areas, as I see it. And we need to continue to try our hardest to end this poverty issue, because I think that is one of the major challenges. It changes the whole dynamics of the house when you're worried. We talked about Maslow a little while ago.
Yep.
If you're struggling with poverty and you're worried about that next meal, there is no way that education is going to be on your priority list. So we need to look at this from a community standpoint and all. I would love to say that Mrs. Elia has the magic, you know, the magic wand right there to bring in an expert or to take over a school board. But I think the people of Rochester, if you're honest with yourself, you truly look yourself in the mirror, whether you're in the schools or in the community, you know the answer to it. You just have to be honest with yourself, and no excuses. We need to end the excuses and start really everybody, whether it's family, communities, businesses, schools, work together.
Now, when it comes to poverty, we had a discussion, a debate on this program recently about a piece written by Nick Hanauer, who is a venture capitalist, a billionaire venture capitalist, lives in Seattle. And he said for years he was part of a philanthropist class, giving $1 million a year to education, expanding charter schools, working with some of the biggest, Paul Allen, Bill Gates, some of the biggest names in the country. And he says he has come to believe that despite all the best efforts at school reform, philanthropy, et cetera, you really can't make more than a little dent without fixing poverty. In other words, there's no reform strong enough to overcome massive inequality in this country. And so unequal outcomes in education are the symptom. The disease is an unequal economy. How do you feel about that?
I 100% agree. I would say that you know, for years we've tried to put more and more money into schools, tried all kinds of programs, and I would agree with that philanthropist right there that putting money into the schools, we can, you know, a relationship, a friendship, a handshake, a kind gesture does not cost money. And if we're looking at relationships and those kind of things that really truly affect human interest and wanting to learn, money's not going to change that. It's the behaviors that we need to change. Now, in terms of the community, well, if we have a tough spot here in Rochester. It's not like there's, you know, high-paying jobs out there right now. There's jobs. I see help wanted signs all over the place. But if you're willing to work for $14, $15 an hour, you're still going to be below the poverty line. So really, those people, if you're working those low-income jobs, they're really trying to get, you know, truly trying to get a better way of life for their families, they're not going to be home for their, you know, their kids. And a person that's got, you know, a really good job that's earning a lot of money, and one parent can stay home, or they, you know, they come home the same time as their kids, that kid is at a total advantage having that parent there as a guiding force, especially if that parent's doing their job. So I would argue that is exactly right. Poverty is the cancer right now that is affecting things in this country. And the haves and the have-nots, from my point of view in the classroom, are substantial. We're starting to become this idea. I hate the term middle class, because that kind of says more like you're middle class. I would say middle income. That middle income bracket's shrinking right now, and we're really becoming a society of haves and have-nots, and we have to be very, very careful with that. And it's very easy for a man that has billions of dollars, including a Secretary of Education that's a billionaire right now, and Mrs. DeVos, to make judgments on education. But they haven't spent days in classrooms in the trenches working with families and kids. And until if they want to come to Brockport and have a crash course in education and student teach for 14 weeks and see what it's really like, then I would like to hear their opinion a little more. But you really have to live the life of a teacher to understand it, or live the life of a parent, you know, to understand what parenting's about.
Are you dissatisfied with the Secretary of Education?
At this point, yes. She has not drawn a hard line on Title IV, which is, and I know Mrs. DeVos, and she's an extremely nice lady. It's not that she's not a mean person, but I think that her understanding of education has not been great. She won't draw a firm line on Title IV monies, which is the money that's given to schools for staff development. And right now, the reason that's a hot topic is because the way that money could be used is for training for safety in the schools. And if you want to see a great video right now, just look at the National Teacher of the Year from 2015, Jayana Hayes, have a questioning session with Mrs. DeVos down in Washington, D.C., and you'll understand that if you're a listener and curious, look online at that. It's a very, very interesting interview. But she has really not drawn a hard line on anything. And in this administration right now, it seems like everybody that's in the president's cabinet, every time they draw a hard line on something, they're gone. She's one of the sole survivors right now. She hasn't drawn a hard line. So it seems that that's one of the challenges. Yeah.
You invoked safety, which mm-hmm. is, you know, it's important in every school, but it is more acutely concerning in different schools. How do you view safety as an issue in schools right now?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. Last year in February, there was the shooting down in Florida, and that put this country in a panic. It was it was magnified in the news quite a bit. And I was interviewed, and along with a lot of other people, it made a national story. And it was on the front page of every major newspaper in the country. And I received a barrage of frustrated people with my response, which was, I don't believe in weapons in our schools. I don't believe in controlling kids through weaponry. I believe in education. And there was a superintendent down in Texas, and that superintendent, he was for arming teachers. And instead of, after I got the barrage and I was a little scared, and, you know, and it made me nervous. I'm a human being, you know, just because I have these titles doesn't make me Superman. I'm a fourth grade teacher at heart. So it was very hard to navigate through. So what I did the smartest thing I possibly could have done. I picked up the phone and called that superintendent in Texas and had a wonderful conversation. And he had seen my name. I had seen his name. So we knew each other. And what he said was they were living 1 hour from the nearest police station. Now, that right there in itself said a lot to me. So if something were to happen on their campus, they got to take care of it themselves. I live in Brockport, you know, police station's 2 minutes away. So that it just, even that right there was an interesting thing. So I started thinking about safety, and I started thinking about short-term and long-term goals. Our short-term goals right now, well, we definitely got to get control of this thing. So if we've got to get control of these things right now, some of the strong measures of double doors, those kind of things, security guards in buildings, might be a short-term measure. But I would ask this, 20 years from now, is that what we really want? And I don't want that 20 years from now. So we need to start getting creative and looking at long-term solutions. And I wish I had the answer to that. It's going to take many, many people and a lot of effort and a lot of hard work to figure out how to solve this problem. But I would like to not see forever this kind of lockdown that we have on schools right now, because we have an extreme lockdown and a worry in this country. We need to get rid of that somehow, and that would be a long-term goal.
All right, we got to try to get a couple quick ones in here. Just tell me briefly why you think sort of work ethic, or at least this grit and resiliency, is making a little bit of a comeback, and what that means.
Oh my gosh, yes. So resiliency, you know, for many, many years, we would say, if a child was really having a struggling time at school, you know, what can we do for you? What can we do for you? But I think we're starting to ask the question now, what can we teach them to do for themselves? And we're looking at education as more of a lifelong project now, as opposed to in the short term, which is a good thing to bring back. Because really, once a student exits 12th grade or exits college, we don't want the learning to stop there. Resiliency is not just about having a bad moment, but resiliency is also about, you know, I'm interested in that subject, so I'm going to find out more about it, or I want to, you know, advance my career, so I'm going to teach myself. And that seems to be, that independence mode, it seems to be coming back quite a bit. The teaching children how to communicate with each other fairly. I'll give you a great example. If we have three kids all sitting next to each other, think pair share, it's called, where you say, turn to a neighbor and tell them, you know, what you think and talk it through. But if you've got three, the person in the middle, what are they thinking? I don't know which way to turn. And the two on the outside are wondering, well, if they don't turn to me, what do I do? So what we do in my classroom, I've seen in other classrooms too, is you teach them, okay, get your partner, but then observe the room. And if there's somebody left out, what are you supposed to do? It doesn't matter who they are, invite them in. And if we have that kind of mentality right there, we're creating an environment where kids are, even the shy kids, are not as worried when they have to talk to other ones because everybody's welcomed.
And in our last minute here, just briefly, a listener points us to the Washington Post. The four finalists in 2016 for the National Teacher of the Year have all left teaching for various reasons. Are you concerned about people who either don't want to get into the profession or are leaving it?
Well, the National Teacher of the Year, Sydney Chaffee, from 2017, is still in the classroom. She's teaching in Boston. And it's the goal of Mandy Manning this year, who's the 2018, to go back to the classroom. She teaches out in Tacoma, Washington. 2016 is still in the classroom. 2015 is not. That's Jayana Hayes, who's a congresswoman now, and is doing a very successful job down in Washington. So I would say, but I do have a worry with my cohort. Out of the 56 of us, because we do include territories, I would say it would be a guess, 15 have now left the classroom to pursue other things. And that's a shame because that's a great, they represent our profession. We're not the most talented, but I would say we represent and that we have to stay in the classroom.
Well, I hope we can continue to have these kinds of conversations.
Thank you. I enjoyed this very much.
Christopher Albrecht is the 2018 New York State Teacher of the Year, teaches fourth grade at Fred W. Hill School in Brockport, and last Friday, was one of five inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. But as you say, just a fourth grade teacher at heart still.
Oh, always. I'm not leaving the classroom anytime soon. It's the best life ever.
Thanks for what you do. Thanks for being
here. Thank you, Evan.
Dolores, thanks for the great work volunteering with us on Friday. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a beautiful weekend wherever you are, and we'll talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.